there was lots and lots of anti-war activity in the base, on the base, in the barracks, in the chow hall, on the job site, and then also outside the gate on the weekends, usually just a few people standing out there with their signs, 7, 8, 9, 10 people, you know. And I can just imagine what they're saying. You think it does any good? You think any of them are paying any attention to us? You think we'll ever stop this war? And little did they know that we were talking about them and the war all the time.
Bruce Gagnon is the co-founder and coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He spoke at Reversing Falls Sanctuary in Brooksville, Maine on March 26th as part of their Spring Lenten series featuring individuals Robert Chatterley has painted for his Americans Who Tell the Truth series. Bruce Gagnon.
I thought I'd start out by telling you a little bit about myself. I grew up in an Air Force family. My dad, actually from Rumford, Maine, he grew up in the paper mill in Rumford, working there, and he joined the Air Force during the Korean War. He was in Korea and then he was in Vietnam after that. We moved around all the time, every couple years. So we lived in England and Germany and California, South Dakota, Florida, and now I'm living here in Maine. So I really kind of, in my life, lived in many, many different kind of places. And I often, when I was young, I didn't like it, you know, because every 2 or 3 years you say goodbye to people that you grow to love. I went to 3 different high schools. That's hard. But now as an adult, when I look back on it, I realize that that's probably one of the key reasons I do the work I do today, was because of all those experiences. And it's interesting that I go frequently to England and Germany, 2 places where I grew up, that had so much influence on the person I became. I realized as an adult that I often think like a German or think like a British person and an American, all mixed up. And so, you know, I'm sort of a cake, you know, with many different ingredients in it. So that's how I came about. In 1968, this is confession time, right? It's sort of like a church. In 1968, I had my first really active political experience working on the Nixon campaign. At that time, we were living up in the northwest of Florida, a place up in the panhandle, so conservative there, they call it Lower Alabama, Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And my dad was stationed at a base there. And so I was 16 working on the Nixon campaign. And I did such a good job that right before the election, they had a fish fry fundraiser. And they invited me to sit at the head table with their guest speaker that particular evening. You might have heard of the guy. He's passed some years ago, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. So this is how I got my start in politics. And from there, it kind of went downhill. In 1971, I tried to join the Air Force. I wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to be a career man. In California, we were living there. I just graduated high school there. And I went to the Oakland Induction Center for my physical. And they told everybody to get there early. And there's a long line of people. And I'm waiting in line to go in. It's not open yet. And there's this woman, I later learned she's a mother of a guy that was killed in Vietnam. And she's going down the line begging us, don't go in, don't go in. She's wailing, she's crying. And it's just, you know, breaking my heart. This was my first real anti-war experience as I'm preparing to join the US military. And then behind her was a black man who really had no face. It was all burnt. He had no nose. He had no ears. He had just had holes in his face, and it was all burnt. And he had been to Vietnam and was begging us not to go either. So what a start that was for me. And then we go inside, and as it turned out, I flunked my induction physical because of an old high school football injury. So they said, okay, you're gone. You're out of here. I said, wait. I want to be in the military. I want to be, you know, a career man like my dad. And so they said, well, you have to go over to San Francisco to the Army Presidio Hospital and get a waiver. So they give me a bus ticket. I get on this bus full of all these other draftees who were claiming they got flat feet and all these other ailments and psychological problems, and they can't really go to Vietnam because it would be a terrible thing. So I get on with them, and I'm very sheepish, you know, and everybody's telling everybody their story. And me, what's my story? I'm a free man, but I'm trying to get in the military. So anyway, I got my waiver, so I get into the military. And after my training, I'm sent to a base in California called Travis Air Force Base, an airlift base for the war in Vietnam. And so GIs come from all over America to get on the planes to go to Vietnam. And then when the planes return, they bring the body bags of the dead soldiers and the walking wounded back to our base. And so there was lots and lots of anti-war activity in the base, on the base, in the barracks, in the chow hall, on the job site, and then also outside the gate on the weekends, usually just a few people standing out there with their signs, 7, 8, 9, 10 people, you know. And I can just imagine what they're saying. You think it does any good? You think any of them are paying any attention to us? Do you think we'll ever stop this war? And little did they know that we were talking about them and the war all the time in the barracks. And as it turned out, I just think sometimes that it was providential that I've been on this path, that because I just had one glorious experience after the other that led me here today. So I check into the barracks my first day at Travis Air Force Base, and they look down this clipboard, and the guy goes, "Oh my God, I'm sorry, man. I'm really sorry. We've only got one room left. Oh man, get your bags, follow me." We go down this long, dark hallway, last door on the left. And he keeps apologizing, "Really, man, we'll get you out of here as soon as possible." And I'm thinking, okay, he's going to open the door, and it's going to be a real little broom closet with a cot. And I'll stay in there 2 or 3 nights, right? What else could it be? And he opens the door, and we walk in, and there are anti-war posters all over the wall. And so as it turns out, this was one of the leading organizers of the GI resistance movement against the war. And they were keeping him isolated because they wanted to kick him out. They didn't want to put anybody in there with him and have him infect them. But they had run out of rooms. "We'll get you out of here as soon as we can." And they had a blue refrigerator, I remember, too, which you weren't allowed to even have, a refrigerator. And then he closes the door, and there I am. And so at night, there's a knock on the door, and these white guys would come in with chairs, and they sit just like this in a circle in our little room. And I'm sitting in the corner. They're talking about the war, and I'm thinking, oh my God, these are communists. Another night, there was a knock on the door, and there were black guys come in with chairs, sit in a circle. They were Black Panthers from the cities talking about racism in the military, racism in America. And I'm sitting in the corner saying, oh, these are definitely communists. And then they started smoking marijuana, which I had heard of before. I had heard of it, and I promise you, I swear to God, in the immortal words of Bill Clinton, I never, ever inhaled, not one time. But you know, we've learned a lot in the years since 1971 about the effects of secondhand smoke on innocent bystanders, okay? And so I believe that I was deeply, deeply both traumatized and medically affected by this marijuana smoke that was drifting around in my room. And this has much to do with the fact that within about 6 months, I decided I too was a peace activist. So that's how I got started. And after about 6 months in the military, I felt like I figured out what was going on. And so I decided I wanted to get out. And they had this career counseling session every 6 months where they're trying to talk you into staying to be a lifer, as they were called. And I said, no, I want to get out. I feel like I've become a conscientious objector. And their question was, well, what's your history? Do you come from a traditional peace church, Quaker Mennonite, Church of the Brethren? No. My dad was in the military. I was a young Republican for Nixon. So, sorry, you're staying in. So I did 3.5 years of what I called hard time. Because after I figured out what was going on in Vietnam, and I had read the Pentagon Papers by the time I got out, the secret history of the government's lies in order to sell the Vietnam War to the American people, I was ready to get out. And I knew that I wanted to do something good with my life and was determined to try to find out what that was. I was going to school at the University of Florida, studying sociology and political science, and again, wanting to do something good, but not having a clue what that really meant. And just ready to graduate, and there was another providential knock on my door. It was this beautiful man, Reverend Fred Eister, with the National Farm Worker Ministry, inviting me to come out and leaflet students on the campus for the farm worker lettuce boycott in California. And would I do that tomorrow? I said, well, yeah, I have a test in 2 days. I'm just closing in on graduation. I have 3 classes left, and that's it. I'm done. Oh, but he was so nice, and we talked for hours, and I loved the man just immediately. And so the next day, I skipped my class, and I went, and I was shy. I was always very shy, but the process of handing a leaflet to someone was, really drew me out of my shyness, and I had a great time. And so they said, would you come back tomorrow? I said, you know, I can't. I have a test tomorrow. I can't. No way I can skip class tomorrow. But I did. I skipped my class. I came back the next day. They offered me a job as a union organizer working with the United Farm Workers Union in Florida, organizing fruit pickers. And that's what I did. I never finished college. I have to confess. And I never regretted it, ever. And so by the this was 78, I went to work for the farm workers. And so by 1980, and I went to work on other social justice issues in Orlando, Florida. And then by 82 and 83, Jimmy Carter's running for re-election and cutting social programs in order to build up the military because he wanted to appear strong in his run against Ronald Reagan. And so I began moving into the peace movement at that time.
Bruce Gagnon is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He spoke in Brooksville, Maine on March 26th.
1983, I went to work full-time for the peace movement, Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, where I worked for 15 years. And in 1983, Ronald Reagan is now president. The Cold War is at its height. And he is deploying the Pershing cruise missiles to Europe, nuclear tipped. And the Pershing missile made in Orlando, Florida, I'm organizing protests outside the building. And my youngest sister is inside the building soldering the circuit boards for the Pershing missile that will now be sent to Germany. And after it was deployed, I was invited to come to a conference in a place called Mutlangen, Germany, in southern Germany, where this Pershing missile was deployed. I went there, and it's a small town. Right in the heart of the town, the center of the town, is a U.S. Army base. And every day they send the nuclear missile out on trucks. It's one of these kind where they raise it up and fire it from the truck, ground-based launcher, mobile, they call it. And so we ran out of this conference building, went out and blocked the trucks as they're coming out of the base. I'll never forget it. And every day, these people in that community were just so fearful that they were going to be incinerated at any time. And I'll never forget, one of them gave me a picture on Christmas Day, inside the base, the U.S. military raised all of the Patriot missiles to firing position, and the whole town was freaking out. Totally traumatized that the United States was going to launch these on Christmas Day. Never forget that. What a sinful thing to do to people. Terrible. But these people were determined, and I want you to know that they organized all the time, bringing people into Mutlangan from all over the country. The Quakers would come and hold a church service right outside of the gate. Another time they'd bring a symphony from Stuttgart and they'd play beautiful classical music outside the front gate. And another time somebody would come from somewhere else and they would do something else. And eventually, the base was closed. The nuclear missiles were taken back to the United States. And when I returned some years later, they took me into the nuclear bunkers to show me how they had been converted. Now they were holding sand to be spread on the roads in the winter in Mutlangan. What a great, great thing to see. Our friend Dud, who couldn't be here today because he's luxuriating down in Apalachicola, Florida, my old stomping grounds, the Gulf Coast. But he asked me to make sure that I talked about Jeju, Okinawa, Russia, and China. So I want to do that. Jeju Island, a place that Dud and I have both been to repeatedly. 500-year-old fishing and farming community. You all can relate to that, right? That culture. And the southern tip of Jeju Island. Jeju Island is just off the Korean Peninsula. 500-year-old fishing and farming community. But the United States has decided we're going to pivot our military forces to the Asia Pacific in order to surround Russia and China. This was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. This was their plan they made. And so this is now underway. 60% of U.S. forces pivoting into the Asia Pacific in order to encircle Russia and China. And so they need more barracks for our troops. They need more ports of call for our warships. And they need more airfields for our warplanes. And so communities throughout Asia Pacific are being torn apart in order to build these installations for this U.S. pivot. And so on Jeju Island, little Kangjeon village, 2,000 residents in this 500-year-old fishing and farming community where they worship nature, on the rocky coast, the sacred rocky coast, Gurumbi, they called it. They would go and pray to their relatives and honor nature. And the United States Navy gave the specifications for a Navy base to the Korean Navy, the Korean government, and said, build this for us. It's called cost sharing or burden sharing. You might have heard of it. We're now getting our allies to pay for our bases in order to cut our costs. And so Samsung, which surprisingly construction division, became the lead contractor. Carolyn also, by the way, I don't want to forget, has also been there too. And so the rocky coast was dynamited and blasted and eventually covered in concrete. The endangered soft coral that moves under the water, it's alive and moves, is now dying because of all the dredging and construction that's going on to build the base. The endangered dolphins that swim around the entire island of Jeju no longer come near there anymore. People don't see them hardly at all anymore. And just yesterday, for the first time, a U.S. Navy destroyer, an Aegis destroyer, outfitted with so-called missile defense systems, made its first visit to Kangjeon Village, and the people protested against it, saying, go away.
Fellow Veterans for Peace member Dud Hendrick forwarded to Gagnon an article about the joint U.S.-South Korean naval port on Jeju Island, South Korea.
And Dud, he emailed me a story that he found in some obscure military website that said, it was a story about this ship going there. That's how we learned about it. And it said that the executive officer on the ship said that when we get there, we're going to have sports exercises with the Korean Navy and everything else. And then we're going to do a community relations give back to the community. Well, let me tell you what, the people of Kangjeon Village were highly, highly, highly angry when they read that. And they said, if you really want to give us back anything, please leave and don't ever come back again. Another place Dud and I have been to is Okinawa, where there are 32 U.S. bases, 32 U.S. bases on the island of Okinawa. As you drive along through the main highway, it's just one base after the other. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. It's unbelievable. But there's a new base being built there for our warplanes, and it's on Ora Bay. Ora Bay, pristine bay, endangered coral reefs, sea mammals called dugongs, relatives of the manatee. Only three of them left. They live there. And so today, what's going to happen? They're going to dump millions of dump truck loads of landfill on top of the bay. And they're going to build a twin runway for U.S. warplanes on top of the bay. And so for the last 3 years, daily, nightly, people have been protesting. Old women by the hundreds every day coming to the construction gate, sitting down, blocking the construction gate. And the Japanese police come and drag them off. And then they come back again, day after day after day. Just like in Kangjeon Village on Jeju Island, for 9 years there, people have been doing the same kind of resistance. And so when we go there and then we start to leave, guess what they say to us? What are you going to do when you go home? What are you going to tell the American people when you go home? It's a question about solidarity. What does solidarity really, truly mean? What does it mean? Not only solidarity for the people, but solidarity for the ocean, for the coral, for the sea life, for the sacred rocks, where beautiful plants and other sea life grow amongst the rocks. What about that? Last May, I went to Odessa, Ukraine. You've probably heard about Ukraine, right, lately? Russia invaded Ukraine. Russia took Crimea. You've probably heard all that. Well, on May 2nd, 2014, in the city of Odessa, people were gathering petition signatures, thank you, outside of a big, I think it's like four-story trades union hall building. In early 2014, right at the beginning of the year, there was a Maidan in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. There was a overthrow of the government, the elected government. I watched the whole thing in real time on video, YouTube. I've been studying the situation in Ukraine since that time. You might have heard of Victoria Nuland, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs for the United States, for Hillary Clinton's State Department, married to Robert Kagan, one of the persons that created the Project for a New American Century during the Bush administration, that said that we were going to take over the world and control the planet on behalf of corporate globalization. Well, Victoria Nuland was there at the Maidan when people were rioting in the streets to try to overturn the elected government of Ukraine, handing out bread. John McCain came and stood alongside of avowed Nazis who were giving this sign, and John McCain standing right next to them, encouraging them, telling them they had the full support of the American government and the American people. As it turns out, in Western Ukraine, which is over by Poland, more of the European side of Ukraine, historically they've been Nazis. And in fact, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union during World War II, remember that? When 27 million Russians were killed during the Nazi invasion, 27 million defending their country. They didn't invade Germany. Germany invaded them. 27 million people died defending the Soviet Union at that time. They swept through Ukraine, and the Nazis in Western Ukraine, followers of Stefan Bandera, put on Nazi uniforms, joined the invasion of the Soviet Union. And they still are active today in Western Ukraine. In Eastern Ukraine, alongside the Russian border, what they call the Donbass, historically Russian-speaking, Russian cultural people, they live right there on the border. It's like living on the border between New Hampshire and Maine, you know? You have kind of mixed loyalties. And so, right after the coup and a new government was installed in Kiev in January of 2014, U.S. created this whole mess. First thing they did was to announce that speaking of Russian was now illegal in Ukraine. You no longer can speak Russian. People in the middle to the east of Ukraine speak Russian. It's their primary language. And so they began gathering signatures and holding peaceful demonstrations saying, we want a federated Ukraine, which means we want to elect our own governor, we want to elect our own mayors instead of having them appointed by Kiev, so that we can honor our cultural traditions. And they then began being attacked by the Nazis who were brought in. So on May 2nd, 2014, in Odessa, which is more on the eastern side of Ukraine, it's a port city, busloads of Nazis from Western Ukraine were brought in, and they came to the Kolokova Square, where people were gathering signatures, petition signatures, by the Trades Union Hall, and they were attacked by these Nazis, who had already made Molotov cocktails. They had bats and steel rods. They had gas masks, helmets, and they attacked these people. And the people ran inside the building, closed the doors to protect themselves. And then the Nazis began taking the Molotov cocktails and throwing them at the doors and throwing them through the windows. And soon the place was on fire. And you just go to YouTube and just Google it. It's all there. You can see who were the guys that were standing in the crowd shooting at the people in the windows, coming to try to get some air as the smoke began to fill their lungs. And some of the people even jumped out of the windows to try to, you know, get some air and survive. And when they hit the ground, they were beaten to death with bats. And when the fire department that was nearby tried to come, the Nazis blocked the fire trucks and wouldn't let them come to put out the fire. 46 people were killed that day. Some of the Nazis went through a side door, actually went in the building with gas masks on. They were prepared. They knew what they were doing. And to this day, not one person has even been arrested, let alone prosecuted, for these crimes. And in fact, just in the last 2 weeks, two of the fathers, people my age, in their mid-60s, fathers of the people that were killed have been arrested. For what? To try to persecute those that are calling for justice. But why? Why did this happen? What is going on here? Why did the United States want this coup in Ukraine? What is really happening?
Bruce Gagnon, co-founder of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, spoke at Reversing Falls Sanctuary on March 26 as part of their Lenten series.
You know that NATO has been expanding on steroids for some time. At the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev was promised by Secretary of State Jim Baker during the first Bush administration that NATO would not expand eastward towards the former Soviet Union, towards Russia, if Gorbachev agreed to the reunification of East and West Germany. He agreed, saying, but please, you must promise us that NATO will not expand eastward up to Russia, because we've already been through the Hitler invasion. Napoleon tried to take us out years back before that. We don't want it to happen again. Oh, no, don't worry about it. NATO will not expand. Well, guess what? Bill Clinton came into office. NATO has been expanding on steroids. And today, Russia is being surrounded by NATO. Why? I think it's climate change. If you look at the map, go home and look at the map, and you see that Russia has the largest land border with the Arctic Ocean. And the RAND Corporation, the place that wrote the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg smuggled out to the New York Times during the Vietnam War, today the RAND Corporation has come out with a study saying that we have to balkanize Russia. We have to break Russia up into separate little countries. It's too big, and it has too big of a border with the Arctic. The oil corporations want to get up there and drill, baby, drill, now that the ice is melting. And they want access, and they want control. And the only way to get it is to balkanize Russia. But that's a big undertaking. So you've got to demonize them in the eyes of the people of America and people all over the West. And that, I believe, is what is going on today. Let me wrap up by talking about our bioregion. Years ago, we used to talk about in the environmental movement that we needed to look at our bioregion and see what was going on in our own area and its implications for sustainability, for our ability to live on this planet, and try to make changes within our own bioregion. And if everybody did that, we'd have a real movement. So what is in our bioregion here in Maine when it comes to climate change? First of all, I think it's important to know that the military industrial complex, the Pentagon, the military, has the largest carbon footprint on the planet. The U.S. military is the biggest contributor to carbon on the entire planet. And in fact, during the time of the Kyoto Protocols, the United States refused to sign the Kyoto Protocols, the climate change protocols, unless the U.S. military was exempted. And recently, the renewal in Paris just a year or so ago, again, the United States demanded that the military had to be outside of that. So there can be no solution to climate change until we deal with this elephant in the middle of the room that happens to have a major installation in our bioregion, right where Mary Beth and I live in Bath, Maine. And so for some time now, we've been organizing a campaign in Bath calling for the conversion of Bath Ironworks. Let's build solar. Let's build commuter rail connecting every corner of Maine. You know, old timers say that in Maine in the old days, you could get everywhere in the state by rail. Why can't we do that, getting us out of our gas-guzzling cars, which are major contributors to climate change? Why can't we build tidal power and offshore wind turbines, all at Bath Ironworks? And there's a study by the University of Massachusetts at Amherst Economics Department that says if we did that, we would essentially double the jobs at Bath Ironworks, because military production is capital intensive, meaning you spend a lot of money and you get fewer jobs. But every other kind of production is labor intensive. You get more jobs when you do these other things than if you were building military hardware. And so we're calling for a conversion of the hearts of the people of Maine, the minds of the people of Maine, and the actual product that we build in our community. This conversion would hopefully allow us to have empathy and to show solidarity with the people of the world, because this current military addiction that we have, this addiction to war, endless war, to military production, that it is impacting people around the world, like on Jeju Island and in Okinawa and many, many, many other places. So last June, there was another christening, as they call it, at Bath Ironworks, of a new Zumwalt destroyer, $4 billion. Traditional destroyers, $1.5 billion. New Zumwalt, $4 billion. What happened there, right? That's a whole nother story. Anyway, 12 of us stepped out into the road as a Navy crew marched down to come in for the christening. 12 of us, including Dud, stepped out into the road right in front of the Navy crew. Some of us sat in the road, others stood. We were arrested. We had a trial. We were found guilty. The judge, a very conservative LePage appointee, was wonderful. And he let us speak, and he let us tell our story, and he only gave us 30 hours of community service each, which I think is pretty remarkable. Well, as it turns out, next Saturday, April 1st, and this ain't no April Fool's joke, they're having another christening of another destroyer there, coming on the heels of a visit to our friends in Kangjeon Village on Jeju Island. And we're again gathering people to come to witness, to call for the conversion of Bath Ironworks, but we're also asking for some people to come and step out into the road. And so far, we have some volunteers.
A week after Gagnon's talk, on the 1st of April, 9 people were arrested outside Bath Ironworks, or BIW, during the so-called christening of an Aegis destroyer. Those arrested ranged in age from 37 to 92. The protesters were calling for the conversion of the BIW facility from making warships to commuter rail systems or alternative energy components like solar panels and wind turbines.
I'd like to see a day come where we have the Quakers come and hold a service outside of Bath Ironworks on a Sunday. I'd like to see some local symphony or music group come and perform music outside of Bath Ironworks. I'd like to see a delegation come from the Blue Hill Peninsula on a particular time and come and bring their message and have a delegation come from Bangor and maybe one from Portland and, you know, at another time, and have the entire state begin to dialogue with itself over what kind of product we should be building with our tax dollars in our state. What do we really want to be about? Let me conclude with this. One of my dear friends, Mariah Holt, former state senator, she lives in Bath, and Betty King, longtime friends. During the Vietnam War, they opened up in a downtown Bath a peace office, peace center. But they helped close down Maine Yankee, the nuclear power plant in the state, and they worked on it for many, many, many years. And they've just published a book telling their whole story. And at the end of the book, they quote a Buddhist monk from Vietnam. It has to be Thich Nhat Hanh. And somebody asked him, "What do you think of the American peace movement?" And he answered, quote, "We think of drops in a bucket. We drops don't care where in the bucket we fall. But in America, everybody wants to be the last little drop that makes the bucket overflow." I ask you to become a drop. Thank you.
An audience member asked Bruce Gagnon about the probability the U.S. will do something, quote, really foolish, end quote, in the next 15 years.
High. Very high probability. And it's very scary. First, I want to share with you some information that I think is really, you know, they say the numbers don't lie, okay? People lie, but the numbers, empirical evidence, doesn't lie. There's a group called SIPRI, S-I-P-R-I, stands for Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. Every year they do a study on global military spending. Who's spending what percent of global military, you know? And so in 2015, the United States spent 36% of the global share. 36. You add NATO countries to the US share, more than 50%. Now, what about those evil Russians who now we're told by Time Magazine and MSNBC and CNN that they want to recreate the former Soviet Union, right? Putin, the most dangerous man in the world. CNN 2 weeks ago, they had a whole thing on Putin, the most dangerous man in the world. What is their share? 4%. 4%. How does 4% go up against 50%? And come to find out, last year in 2016, they cut their military budget in Russia, largely because of sanctions and decline in oil prices. And guess what? 2017, last week, Russia announced they're cutting their military budget by 25%. So they got to be hovering around 3% now, okay, of the global share. How in the world are they going to take on the United States and invade Europe? It's all BS. And we are being prepared the way we were prepared in 2003 for shock and awe. Saddam's got weapons of mass destruction. And then we were prepared to take down Libya. And we've turned them into failed states and messes, an endless war that is only benefiting who? The military-industrial complex. So yes, I think absolutely the United States today is encircling both Russia and China. But there's another question here of why. Why are we doing that? And I think it has a lot to do with this. Russia and China have said they don't like the way the United States throws its weight around the world and bosses everybody around. Unipolar power. One. Us, number one, we're running the world. Russia and China say we want a multipolar world. We want to have a world that is run by lots of countries together. And so what have they done? They've created a terrible sin. They've created a thing called BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, BRICS. It stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And they've created an alternative to the IMF and the World Bank. When the IMF and the World Bank give you a loan, your country, they say, okay, now you've got to cut social spending, you've got to privatize, you've got to sell off all your national assets to the big corporations, and they hollow that country out. Look what's happened to Greece, look what's happening to Portugal, Spain, Italy, etc., etc. That's why we got all this internal EU Brexit stuff going on, because people are fed up with it, that structure. So BRICS is saying we're creating an alternative economic bank, we're going to make loans to countries, and we're not going to exploit the living hell out of them. We want stability in the world, not this endless chaos that the United States is fostering. And then just 2 days ago I read that Russia and China, oh my God, this is the end of the world. They have now decided to only trade in their own currencies. No more will they use the dollar. And this is an assault on the power of the American economic control. And so I think this is what's driving it. And the United States knows that it has just a very short window of opportunity to destroy this process before it becomes established and gains a momentum that is irreversible. And that's why I believe we're hell-bent on taking them down, which is extremely dangerous, as you can imagine.
Bruce Gagnon is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He spoke in Brooksville, Maine on March 26th. One person asked Bruce Gagnon why the U.S. launches satellites from Russian soil.
Why? The reason why is because America does not have the ability to launch its own stuff anymore. They keep blowing up, and they don't have the technology anymore. They say that inside of the U.S. space world, the old guys are retiring, and the younger guys, they don't have enough younger people that know what to do. And so the United States is now hiring the Russians to launch some of our, even our military satellites. That's how we get to the International Space Station. The astronauts now, they have to be launched by Russians. But the Russians have given the United States notice. They're tired of being kicked around by the U.S. And they've given the U.S. notice saying, next year, that's the end of it. And I read one Russian commentator say that we recommend that the United States secure a very big trampoline in order to launch its astronauts to the space station.
A dialogue began about how the conversion of BIW could be financially possible.
Well, who's financing the current process?
Someone said the military-industrial complex. And then specified General Dynamics.
Well, yeah, but where does General Dynamics get their money to build these things? Anybody know?
From us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. You. So you're financing the operation. You think that the American people would have some input into what their money was being used to do. All right? As we're looking at the reality of climate change sweeping our way, you think that we'd want to say that we'd rather, I'm sorry, we've got enough of those things. We'd rather now go over here and do this to make sure that our children, our grandchildren have a chance to live on this planet, right? So, yeah, it seems rather academic. Mary Beth, my partner, has become an expert on this conversion thing, I want you to know. And she's telling me a story just the other day that during World War II, at the startup of World War II, President Roosevelt, correct, declared he was taking over all manufacturing in America. He was taking over, and he was nationalizing it. And everybody, no matter what they were doing, she tells me, if they were making silk pajamas, now they're going to make parachutes, okay? Everybody, the whole country on a war footing, we made stuff and they turned it around like that. So now today, we got this really big enemy and it ain't Russia and it ain't China. It's called climate change. You think that we'd want to nationalize our production system with our money and deal with climate change? And the studies show that we'll get more jobs out of it as well. It's a win-win-win all the way for labor, for the environmental groups, for the peace community, for social justice groups, and for the planet. It's a win. But you know what? Somebody's got to make the demand repeatedly, and that's where we come in.
Then Bruce Gagnon spoke about BIW workers who support conversion of the facility.
Peter Woodruff, one of our dear friends, works there. He just retired recently. He came to me one day and said, I want to start a petition saying we want to build wind turbines at BIW. And I said, okay, I'll help you. And he said, I'm probably going to get fired, but I'm going to do it. And so he started going. They have three or four different plants at BIW. They've grown so much over the years. So he went to one plant and stood outside in the morning before work, and he collected 800 signatures out of about, at that time, 4,500 workers, but he couldn't get to everybody, and a few other people helped him. And then he came to me and he said, what am I going to do now? I said, well, would you be open to talking to the Times Record, our, you know, Mid-Coast newspaper? Well, they'd really fire me then. Okay, I'll do it. So I took him in, I arranged for a meeting with the editor, he talked to the editor. The editor was so impressed, Peter gave him all the petitions. And the editor said, whoever thought the Navy base in Brunswick would close? And so he wrote an editorial congratulating Peter Woodruff, calling him farsighted, a visionary, a prophet in his own time. And saying, you know what, we need to do this. We need to begin talking about this in our community. And Peter was never fired. And in fact, in his last couple years, he worked in the tool room handing out tools. And every morning he said, people lined up, a couple hundred people, can you imagine, to come by the tool room to check out tools for the day. And there's a big bulletin board there. And he would put up there every day on the bulletin board all these flyers about next christening protest by the peace community. And he'd put copies of my blog on there. He said one day some guy came up to him and said, are you related to Bruce Gagnon? He said, no, why? He said, well, you keep putting this stuff up there. They never fired him. He had a lot of support. And then he, at his own expense, he made bumper stickers that said, we want to build, save BIW, build wind turbines. And he started handing them out to the workers, and they put them on their lunch pails. Most of them, not everyone, but most of them would like to feel good about something they're doing. Most of them, you know, they just need the paycheck. They need to survive. They need a job. And so most of them were very open, but they can't do it by themselves. They need the community to help call for this, you know, make this demand. So they need us.
One audience member said that people don't like to see veterans pushed around and arrested. He wondered about the impact their presence could have at BIW protests.
Yeah, well, last June when there were 12 of us arrested, four of us were members of Veterans for Peace. We were the four in the front as we approached the Navy crew as they were walking down the street. We were not calling the Navy crew names. We didn't say anything, actually. We just held a banner. And the banner was made brilliantly by a group of artists that showed the process of converting Bath Ironworks to rail, to wind turbines. And that's what the banner depicted. That was our message. There were four of us that were veterans. And this time, next week, there'll be several veterans again. So yes, we definitely, but we also are inviting everybody to participate. We had the youngest person last June was 45 years old. It was like an escape from a senior citizen center. They were mostly, everybody was over 60, except for the one guy, 45 years old. And it was really amazing because I think it had a really big impact on the judge. And it was one reason that the judge was so, I think, generous to us in spirit. It was because he really respected the elders that were there that had done this. And it's going to be the same way again on April 1st. It's mostly going to be elders from across the state.
Bruce Gagnon next described how the U.S. is still working towards the weaponization of space.
Basically, everything the U.S. military does today, everything they do, is coordinated and directed by space technology, space satellites. When the U.S. launched Shock and Awe in 2003 in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used in the initial attack were directed to their targets by military satellites. Before the attack happened with military satellites, the United States pre-identified all of Saddam Hussein's targets. And so in the first 2 to 3 days of the war, it was really over because they bombed 95% of them. And they left a 5% capability that they then played cat and mouse with during the remaining weeks of the war. They used 100 cruise missiles at $1 million apiece. You can see the writing on the wall here. The longer they dragged the war out, the more money they made, resupplying, you know, the system. And so it was also a field test for the space warfare technology system. And so today now, the U.S. has unrivaled ability that they say they will use at the Space Command to control space and the Earth below on behalf of corporate interests. So yes, indeed, it's worse than ever. And they say also at the Space Command that Star Wars, that's the generic name for all of this, will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. I call it pyramids to the heavens. They're building the pyramids of our time, the weapons corporations of the pharaohs, and we're the slaves that will build the pyramids on behalf of the pharaohs. And so in one of the industry publications called Space News a few years ago, they had an editorial where they said, you know, we've got to be responsible corporate citizens. We've got to come up with a dedicated funding source to pay for this largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And we have. And we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure that dedicated funding source. And they spelled it out and they said it's the entitlement programs that America officially are: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program. These are the programs that they've targeted, the military industrial complex has targeted to defund. And that's why we hear all this stuff on NPR and other places about how the entitlement programs need to be reined in, that Medicare is out of control. We got to increase the retirement age on Social Security. Maybe we ought to privatize Social Security, turn it over to Wall Street so young people can make more profit during the course of their retirement investments. You know, you've all heard this, right? This is what they're after because they've got to come up with the money to pay for it. But even that's not enough. They now are going around the world to all the allies. You got to help us pay for this. You might have heard the last 3 or 4 presidents saying that NATO's got to pay more of the share of NATO. They got to pay 2% of their budget, each NATO member now, because we're carrying too big of a load. But you know what this really means? They've got to help pay for this very expensive space technology program. A military satellite costs several hundred million dollars. Costs several hundred million dollars to launch a satellite. They often blow up. You have to start all over again. Then they have all these ground stations all over the world talking to the satellites, relaying signals. That costs big money. And so this thing is just enormously expensive. And so the allies are now having their arm twisted in order to get them to help pay for this program.
Will they pay for it?
Some of them are, and some of them are not. It depends on how much people internally in their countries and in ours defend social progress. Because what we're talking about here, and we've seen with the new Trump budget, $54 billion more for the Pentagon, 10% increase, cuts, Meals on Wheels, cuts, child nutrition programs in schools, and on down the line, right? So the question is, will we defend social progress in America? And will our friends around the world defend social progress in their country? I liken it to 2 trains on a collision course. One of them is called Endless War, militarization of, you know, space. That's one train. And the other train is social progress, dealing with climate change, environmental concerns, heading for a collision. Question is, which one gets derailed first before the collision happens? And that's our job, isn't it?
At the end of the question period, Anne Ferrara of Reversing Falls Sanctuary read the quotation scratched above Bruce Gagnon's portrait. To see the portrait, visit AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org. Thank you for listening. Bruce Gagnon's blog is space4peace.blogspot.com. For WERU, I'm Carolyn Coe.